It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
Helter Skelter is coming down.
Down fast.
Yes, it is the Dearly Departed Podcast, episode 11, and this is going to be a long one.
That's what she said.
This is.
We'll just call this one spoiler.
Yes, this one's called Spoiler Heavy Alert.
Yeah.
We will be talking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and the Mansons and Quentin Tarantino and all of that stuff. So we'll warn you again, but we are going to talk about all of it. We're going to talk about the ending. We're not going to hold back.
Turn off now.
We waited three weekends, so everybody that wanted to see the movie would have a chance to see the movie. So. We'll warn you one more time before we get into it, but just FYI, if you haven't seen it yet, pause this. It'll still be here when you get back. Go watch it and then come back and listen to this.
We'll be waiting for you.
All right. There it is, because I hate spoiling movies, but we have to.
We can't wait.
We can't wait any longer. We waited so long to do this. So anyways, with that, hate mail?
Well, you didn't introduce yourself yet.
Oh, crap. You're right.
That's okay.
I'm Mike Dorsey.
And I'm Scott Michaels.
Is that a new tattoo?
No.
The 69?
No.
1969?
That's the one I showed Tarantino that day, and he's like, man, you're the guy.
Oh, man. Whoa, we just leaped ahead in the show.
Oh, yeah. That's okay. It's a spoiler.
Anyways, I'm Mike Dorsey.
And I'm Scott Michaels.
And this is Dearly Departed Podcast.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so hate mail?
Hate mail.
Well...
You dug into the archives
because everybody a little bit.
We just get nothing but love from everybody on this show. But
I saved a couple of prime ones.
Your website has been another thing over the years. Your Find a Death website.
These are really nasty. Maybe I. I may as well.
Why not?
You know. So there is a photograph. You know, I'll always go for a cheap joke, and it's really difficult for me to go to a place with a like where something horrible happened and get a picture, which I will do,
right.
And not smile. You know,
sure.
It's just what I do, and yeah. I know I'm desensitized, and people that are involved won't like it, and I understand that completely.
Right,
but it's what I do. So I've got this picture. I got this picture of me standing in front of Nicole Simpson's gates. This is the day.
Yes.
About the week of, really, because the crime scene tape you can see is still there.
Yeah,
and they just had a couple of potted plants put in. That was before they changed the address.
Yeah.
And I posted a picture of myself standing in front of it, and okay, I'm smiling. So somebody wrote one of the comments, although they're, you know, wow, this is really fascinating, and, you know, wow, you were there on time. Find your death. Let's do a nice scoop on your brains with shovel. Put your queer blood soaked.
Wow, they got creative.
Put your queer blood soaked attire on evidence bags. I thought, well, there's... Queer blood soaked attire on evidence bags.
It makes more sense when he had the blood.
I
didn't get it.
So
yeah,
I mean queer soaked, queer blood soaked.
Adding the blood ties the sentence together.
Yeah. So very homophobic, heavy on these.
Right.
And here's other one. This one. Oh, this is. I just figured we'd stay with the theme.
Well, why not?
You dick eating dog. Though only a low life faggot would be as disrespectful as you. Someone should kill your gay ass. And with that in mind,
why not?
Welcome to the podcast.
Yes.
It's like you wake up in the morning and you open your meal.
Wonder what life has for me today.
No, these are so. There was a time when these bugged me, and they don't bug me a little bit, but they're more fun to poke fun at than they.
I'm not a troll, but I do enjoy getting a reaction at people.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
Dick eating dog.
Yeah, I mean, the guy put effort into that.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't just a meh.
Was he wrong? I don't know.
I feel like, I feel like people knew how to write hate mail back then. Now it's just meh.
That's
back
true.
Back then, they put some effort.
That's true.
So just know we respect it more if you put some effort into it.
Please.
So that was some old school findadeath.com hate mail from Scott.
But tons of you know, I mean, we say this every time, but we had an event last week, and so many people came up to me and said,
"And what was the event for, Scott?"
It was for the 50th anniversary of the Tate LaBianca murders.
Yep.
And so many people that came in. People come from other countries. I mean, they were Australia, Scotland, Indiana. And I mean, Australia, Scotland, Canada, I mean, just like real Canada,
right?
Like up, like, you know, well, I'm from Detroit, yeah. So like Ontario is like right across the river, uh-huh. But I mean, like,
deep,
you know,
Canada.
Saskatchewan and
yeah,
stuff
French
like that.
Canada.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So it was really, it's really an honor for people to come in and visit. And so many people just said terrific things about the podcast, and that's really freaking cool.
Yes. And what you did this event, what did you had some cool stuff on display, like temporarily.
Yeah,
right.
We do actually held it over a little bit longer. Some of Sharon Tate's personal items,
because you own her bra and some, mm-hmm. her rollers, her curlers, and some other stuff like that. But you've got some temporarily, like really, there was like a jacket or something.
There is a jacket. The jacket's no longer with us.
Oh, it's really cool looking though.
But yeah, very cool. And but we have like personal items. We have an umbrella. These are all backed up with pictures that are right there. So
right.
It's, you know, and that's always my thing. I love the real things about people. I mean, you could see amazing autographs and things like that, but like things they use on a day to day basis or whatever.
It's one thing
like.
It was a gown they wore one time to a movie premiere. It's another thing when it was like everyday items, right?
Yeah. So it's got like her luggage. I've got two pieces of her hand luggage with her initials on it, and there's pictures of her and Roman coming back from their honeymoon carrying these at the airport. It's really cool.
That is
and,
cool.
And her umbrella and her parents, her father's military uniform and her mom's fur that Sharon bought her. So yeah, it's real Sharon stuff.
Yeah.
And it's in the office, in the shop for a couple more weeks. So if you want to stop by.
Yeah. If you're in the Hollywood area, LA area, come to Dearly Departed's tours location and see that stuff in person. It's cool. And plus all the other stuff. You got another really cool thing. You got a poker chips from the Costa Concordia.
Yeah. It's like, of course we do.
Why not?
But but yeah, it's, you know, some of these things just find their way to us.
Yeah.
And that is certainly a curiosity. So I have poker chips from the Concordia.
That's
and I have
a new
poker
edition.
Chips from the MGM Grand when it went up in flames.
Wow.
Which is now the Bally Hotel.
You could say the Costa Concordia captain gambled and lost.
Oh, that was bad.
Yeah.
And people died.
32.
That's crazy.
Yeah, he had like somebody up on the bridge or something like that and was kind of messing around. And
I think it was.
Something like that, yeah.
And then he left the ship when it was sinking.
Supposedly, yeah. He took,
I mean,
like,
did you
all the stuff you're not supposed to do as
did
a
you
captain.
Hear the Coast Guard telling him to get the fuck back
get
on
back,
the
yeah,
ship?
What are you doing?
Get on the ship, you idiot. You know, I mean, it was, he's like, no, I'm on the shore, and I'm watching. I'm supervising from over here.
I'm remotely captaining.
Oh, my God, that was so uncomfortable. Those poor people on that ship.
So we're kind of getting into news of the day anyways, or week, or month.
It's been a month. Yeah, it's been a few weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah, news of the month. Let's do news of the month.
News of the week.
Well, we kick it off with, he got in just under the wire a couple hours before we recorded this. It got released that Peter Fonda, the iconic actor, passed away at the age of 79. We're recording this on Friday, August 16th. So he just passed away a couple hours ago. Of course, he of Easy Rider fame, what he's probably most famous for, but prolific actor. And I think both of us turned Easy Rider on this afternoon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And immediately we're hit by Ballarat, California,
right.
Which is in one of the opening scenes where he throws his watch away. That is Ballarat, California, which is 20 miles away from Death Valley Barker Ranch, where the Mansons were.
Yeah, it's
where
really
the Manson story ended.
The last
basically.
Habitated, you know, sort of town. They say it's like one of the last ghost towns left. Or it's not even a ghost town. It's a store.
It's a store. And then, there's some old ruins of old buildings there because it was a mining town
back
in the day.
I'd like to go back there.
It's funny because you said in the narration on our movie, 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter,
that I'd never go back.
That you would never go back. And you said that the last time you'd gone, and you definitely were going to go back now. But you do kind of want to go back again.
Armed.
Even though, armed.
I do because it's gone now.
Yeah.
And plus I could take it in more.
Yeah.
You know, because it, you could still take it in. The foundation is still there. But there's no fear. I mean, when we were there, it was freaky.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was there the first time, that was crazy. I mean, there was, you know, the books were on the shelves and there was food in the refrigerator.
Right.
And no one was in it. And I keep thinking maybe they were in the hills or something
like
watching us.
Yeah.
And then you find that pro Manson, we love you, Charlie kind of stuff
that
in there. You're
weird,
like, what the man. Yeah. So it was scary. And I was dumb because I was in my Jeep with no roof. We had like two bottles of water.
Yeah.
And if your car doesn't start, you got 20 miles to Ballarat.
And
those people leave on Friday night for the weekend. So
it's another like 10 or 20 miles to get to Trona from there. Yeah.
Right. So it was, and poor Trona with the earthquake, they got nailed. Yeah. But so I wouldn't mind going back now and being able to take it in and really... really experience that again.
And there's still cool stuff around the house, even though the house is gone.
Yeah.
There's the kind of swimming pool thing that was built there.
Yeah, a pool. Where do they get water out there? You know what I mean? It's so far from anywhere.
I assume there was a spring, because I remember there's like some old cottonwoods that are there that are very drought resistant, but they have to have some supply of water.
Yeah, I mean, they must have power at one point, too.
And what's wild is, you know, that whole area... We got sirens going by. That whole area, there's a ton. It's a rich history area. And I remember I got online when we were making our movie 10 years ago, and I got on like a forum for the Panamints and Death Valley and stuff, like looking for archival footage or photos or anything of the area. And I was not warmly received when I told them what I was doing, because for them, Manson is like this stain on otherwise really cool history
Death
in that
Valley.
Area. You know? Even the Barker Ranch, you know, people know the family and you know the history of that family that owned that ranch. You know, Manson shows up for a few months and puts this dark cloud permanently over that whole area that means something to these people that live out there, you know. So, yeah.
Because people go out to the desert to live. You know, they go there to be off the grid.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you know, back then, 50 years ago
it's
or
exactly
so,
the kind of thing they went there to get away from.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But then again, it's history. I mean, the Ballarat, remember when we were out in front of the place, the guys would go, come in, don't stay out in your car.
Yeah.
And so there's an element of tourism out there, too. And they were the ones that were so generous with information and telling us how to get to the ranch. So
really, he's a good, and I read, his name is Rock.
Yeah.
And it seems to have like a good reputation for being a cool,
just
warm
a
dude.
Nice guy. So I get
but I remember
it.
They had like Wright Cola.
It was warm. Oh my God. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. But when you talk about desolate, it is desolate. There's not many areas left really in modern society where, I mean, we say 20 miles in, but it's 20 miles of death. If you break down 20 miles in, you are in really big trouble.
Yeah.
So Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
That's sad. What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, he was an interesting, complicated man.
Yeah.
You know, both the Fondas are. I got a great Jane Fonda story, too. Easy Rider was a fluke.
Yep.
Easy Rider, someone I know used to represent Jane Fonda when she's doing her workout tour.
Oh, really?
And she said, Jane Fonda, my friend told me that Jane told him that Peter Fonda made more off Easy Rider than Henry Fonda ever made in his career.
Yeah, because they made it for like $300,000 or $400,000, and it made $60 million.
Yeah,
it was like the Blair Witch Project level of like, and they made it for nothing, and then it made a mountain of money,
and still does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a crazy movie. Did you ever go to New Orleans to that cemetery?
I've been to one or two of cemeteries in New Orleans. I don't know if it was the same one that they filmed at, but I've been to a couple of those old, cool.
Yeah, it's the Marie Laveau one.
I've been to the one where Nicolas Cage has his pyramid.
That's it.
Is that it?
Yeah,
yeah,
it
so
is.
Yes, I have.
In fact,
to
the
that
pyramid's
one.
Not far away from that.
All
and you know
right.
who was in that scene? Another person I really talked to really recently. I really, really talked to her was Tony Basil. Remember from Mickey?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, choreographer. She choreographed the Tarantino movie, believe
Once Upon
it.
A Time in Hollywood, yeah.
But she was in Easy Rider.
Yeah.
And she was in the cemetery scene.
Right.
And I was asking her about it, because the woman at the cemetery told us that Peter Fonda broke the tombstone that they were hanging off of on their LSD trip.
Oh, really?
Because
he was hanging on like a statue.
Yeah. But Tony Basil had no recollection of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the famous LSD acid trip.
Yeah, which he claimed was acting, but...
I don't know, man. It looks pretty dang real.
Yeah.
It could have just been acting, but, I mean, we know that Hopper, at least, and probably Fonda, were using drugs pretty heavily. It's kind of notorious for how much, you know, drugs and alcohol made the shoot difficult.
Yeah. And Peter Fonda and Hopper really had a falling out over it.
Hopper sued him for writing credits in the 90s.
And I guess Peter Fonda said that he modified a few lines. If that qualifies him as a screenwriter, then ..
That happens. Those kind of disputes happen all the time, especially when you have improvisation.
Yeah.
Where does the improvisation turn into writing?
Richard O'Brien told me when he was writing the Rocky Horror Show, and the other guys are really, you know, fighting him legally because Brian Thompson and Jim Sharma, the director and the designer, they had a huge falling out. And Richard said, Success has many fathers, but failure is always an orphan.
That's right. That's right.
It's poetic.
I saw Dennis Hopper in person one time. I was at it was a film festival in Burbank, probably 15 years ago, maybe longer. And it was it's called Method Fest. I don't know if it's still around. Method acting.
Mm-hmm.
Method Fest, and I think it was Method Fest, and he was their guest of honor. And festivals, if you don't know, they kind of, all these festivals, they do these honorary awards and stuff, and it's really just to get people to come out. It's like that last film that Burt Reynolds made, right?
The last movie star.
Yes,
that was good.
Just like that is real. Like,
and
that
it's
really
in the back
happens.
Of a pub.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing is real. So yeah. Method Fest was much more professional than that was, but still. And I remember, so we're in this theater, and he rolls in with like his little entourage, probably his publicist and manager or something, and he gets up on stage to speak, and he had no prepared remarks. And he just goes, oh, what am I doing here? What is this?
Like, a very Burt Reynolds.
I mean, it was like they just, it was Hopper, though.
Yeah.
It was just like Burt Reynolds in that film. He was like he rolled out of bed and they picked him up like unannounced and were like, we're going to this thing. And he was like, okay. And he just went and he showed up and there was this theater full of people and he didn't know what he was there for. So I guess that probably happens a lot. But
Did you know that Hopper filled in for James Dean on Giant? At the end, when Jimmy died, Dennis Hopper had to
go. In real life, yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy died, and they had to redo the banquet scene, and Hopper dubbed it.
Uh-huh.
So I thought it was kind of interesting. So Jimmy's last scene in a movie ever was dubbed by Dennis
Hopper.
It's
him, because you see him, he's drunk, right, and he kind of falls off the stage or whatever there in the banquet hall. And then, I remember that, yeah.
So it's just another inadvertent bit of Hollywood history. But I got a chance to talk to who died? Peter Fonda. I got a chance to talk to him a couple of years ago. Now, I have an obligation if I ever meet anybody that was of the time of the 69, you know, the Ted Polansky orbit.
It's crazy this all happened.
I had an opportunity to talk to him and ask him about it. And he told me a great story about Mama Cass. And it was cool. It was just me and him and Troy.
Yeah.
Or Troy and him and I. And he said that Cass Elliott was... that's on my Helter Skelter tour. I always talk about Mama Cass. We go to her house. Now it's Beverly D'Angelo's house, and she thinks we're there because it's her.
And but it's anyway. As the crows fly right over the hill from where the Folger
right.
lived. Yeah.
Yeah. So he told me that Cass was in love with John Lennon, and Cass bought an Alfa Romeo, little Italian sports car, because John Lennon had one, but she didn't know how to drive stick. So she would call Peter Fonda up, and he'd ride his motorcycle over to her house and park it, and he'd get behind the wheel of her car. And he said they'd be driving through, you know, Woodrow Wilson Drive with her hair blowing in the wind with a big smile on her face.
Wow.
And it's like, I mean, to hear a personal story about Mama Cass and from him, and then, you know, just, it was, you could tell there was real joy in his mouth, and then in his smile. Dickie
put
didn't
some joy
dog.
In your mouth. Yeah, okay.
But then I asked him about Manson. It was like, bam, I got shut down. I mean, he was like, the expression changed
there,
and
yeah.
we are done.
Mm-hmm.
Which I understand. You know, it was my obligation to ask it. But they were friends. You know, Sharon and Roma were friends of his. And he traveled in the same crowd as Manson did, too. They probably knew each other. I mean, a lot of people did know Manson, so it's not a mystery anymore.
Or realized, oh, gosh, that guy was around. I remember that. You know what I mean?
Like, the creepy guy. Let's invite him to the party. He shows up with those creepy chicks. Watch him dance, you know? I mean, that was they were entertainment.
Right. And in Easy Rider, they hang out at a hippie commune at one point, remember?
Kind
of in the middle of the film, Yeah.
That's a wild film. I did not enjoy that movie, I'll have to tell you. That was a real... It's like a day in the life, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of like what we're talking about today. It's not really a necessarily a plot-driven movie.
And we talked about how crazy it was, how they made it. You know, the producers that, you know, financed it were not completely all in at the beginning. So what they did was they gave Hopper $40,000 to go and do, like, a test shoot. So most of the New Orleans stuff was shot at the beginning on this test shoot. And they put together just kind of a ragtag crew, apparently. And one of the craziest things is Hopper fought with the crew throughout that whole test shoot. And the crew, I think it's largely like one of the camera operators or the cinematographer didn't like Hopper, and they really fought. Like, I think they even came to, like, you know, blows. Mm. And I think they kind of wanted to get Hopper fired because he'd never directed a movie before. And so when they went to show the dailies to the producers, I think this person on the crew thought that they were going to get Hopper fired by seeing how bad, you know, the footage was or whatever. And instead, you know, the producer's listening to the footage or listening to the audio, and you can hear Hopper, I need this light, I need a light over here, whatever. And nobody was getting it for him. And the producer's like, well, did you get him that light? Hmm. And the guy's like, oh, well, And they basically were like, look, you guys kind of made it harder on him than it should have been. So Hopper went out and, you know, got the funding for the rest of the movie, to shoot the rest of the movie, and they basically revamped the crew as a result of that and got crew that he could work with and went out and shot it for real. But I thought it was interesting, kind of the tables got turned.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of set him up to fail and the opposite happened, you know.
Was Hopper brought in... I heard somebody say recently that Hopper was brought in to replace Rip Torn.
No, I think that was Rip Torn was originally supposed to play the Nicholson role.
Oh.
And Rip Torn and Hopper got into a fight.
Go figure.
And then later on, Hopper claimed that Rip Torn pulled a 6-inch knife on him, and Torn sued him and successfully sued him for defamation. I just recently read this, so I hope that's correct, but yeah. And then I think Nicholson came in and took over that role, that the ACLU lawyer that... Yeah. Torn was supposed to play some.
It's so weird that... Is Peter Fonda represented in the movie? I don't know. I mean, so many people are represented in the movie.
What do you mean represented?
You know, somebody like Michelle Phillips shows up and Cass Elliott shows up and Steve McQueen shows up. I wonder if the Fondas show up or they will in the...
That's a good question. I don't know if he is.
Because, I mean, Jane
in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah. Jane was well a part of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Well, and as we'll talk, there's stuff that didn't make it into the film, obviously. I mean, there were multiple cuts of the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and, you know, what premiered at Cannes, I don't know if it's exactly what ultimately premiered in Hollywood. You know, Tarantino was kind of coy about the whole thing, about what, you know, what version he was going to actually release. So I'm really interested in seeing the digital release of it, because I hope a bunch of the deleted scenes hopefully will be...
They have to.
I don't know if he'll do it. Maybe Tarantino's against that kind of thing. I don't know how he is.
I thought that
he gets kind of weird about that kind of thing, so I don't know if...
Didn't he sign a deal with Netflix to do like a 4-hour version or a 5-hour version?
Man, I freaking hope so.
Me too.
Ugh.
So much stuff didn't make it. And there's easily probably another hour's worth of footage that they could put in there. Because there was that one point where Steve McQueen... You know, literally points out, you know, she dated him and da da da. And, you know, that was really kind of.
Damian Lewis, yeah.
That you could tell that wasn't really, that was kind of added into because they needed to. But I bet you otherwise it would have been explained more so, their relationship.
That was a bit of exposition to cut time out of the movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, well, let's get into some more deaths. Rutger Hauer is probably the next big one the past month. The complicated villain in Blade Runner.
Yeah,
he was also in Sin City, and he played the kind of villain CEO in Batman Begins.
The Hitcher. That was a crazy movie. That was such a crazy movie.
Demented. I haven't seen that one.
Oh my God, that's like Billy. What was it? Billy Zane was like that kind of crazy guy in that Nicole Kidman movie. You know, like trapped on a boat with the psycho, and he was a very good psycho.
So he died at 75 on July 19th in the Netherlands, where he lived, after what was described as a short illness. And just so you guys know, if you hear, I leave the windows open on my apartment when we record, so you can hear the sound of Los Angeles in the background. But this time of year, it being Hollywood, or it being summer, the sound is really just air conditioning units.
And the occasional siren.
It's about 1,000 air conditioning units and the occasional siren, exactly. So next on our list of deaths, Art Neville of the Neville Brothers, 81. He died on July 22nd. After what was described as years of declining health, he had announced his retirement late last year, about 8 or 9 months ago.
Hmm.
Retirement from music, and he passed away.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. Art. Barry Coe, who was in Peyton Place, Follow the Sun, Bonanza, died at 84 of myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a form of cancer, on July 16th.
It doesn't end with an oma.
Yeah. Syndrome. Yeah. Syndrome oma. There you go. Ian Gibbons, the Kinks keyboardist, died at 67 on August 1st, possibly from bladder cancer. RFK's granddaughter, Saoirse Kennedy Hill, this was really tragic, died at 22 of an overdose. And she had a history of depression, and I think she had attempted suicide before and had become a public advocate for, you know, mental health You know, instead of hiding it, she kind of put it out there and tried to be the face of it. And unfortunately, she died at the Kennedy compound, actually, on August 1st. Hal Prince, the prolific Broadway producer and director, Phantom of the Opera, Cabaret, Sweeney Todd, etc. He won 21 Tony Awards.
Wow.
Passed away at 91 on July 31st after, again, a brief illness in Iceland. Of all places.
Was he visiting?
Reykjavik.
Or did he live there?
I don't know if he moved to Iceland or where. Reykjavik, Iceland. And Andrew Lloyd Webber said of him, all of modern musical theater owes practically everything to him. Rusty Taylor, who was the voice of Minnie Mouse and also voiced Simpson characters like the Sherry and Terry twins and Uter. In over 100 episodes, she died at 75 on July 26th.
Yeah, what a great gig, man. Just to sit behind a... Oh.
And she said, and she had a quote. It was something to the effect of, I'm not famous, but the characters I voice are famous, and that's all right with me.
Okay.
Which I think is cool.
So, I got a good story. I just found out this...
About a
voiceover artist. So, you know Alison Arngrim, who was Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. She's a friend of mine. She does a tour with us, the Nasty Nellie Olson tour.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother is... a voiceover legend. I mean, she was the voice of Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Wow.
She was the voice of Gumby. She was whatever Gumby was. She was the voice of Sweet Polly Purebred and the Underdog series. I mean, she was really accomplished. And Allison reached out to me this week, and she said, here's something weird. My mother told me that she once did a voiceover, redubbed Sharon Tate's lines in something. And she said...
No kidding.
Yeah, and she said, you know, my mother couldn't give a shit about it.
Well, that must have been after she died, you would think.
No. Here's the thing. So one of her first movies she did for Filmways was in London, or they filmed it in Europe, called The Eye of the Devil with Deborah Carr and David Niven. And Sharon does a British accent. And I knew that Sharon couldn't do a very good British accent. Sharon was beautiful. And not, you know, she was not, you know, I'm going to sound evil anyway I say it, and I don't mean it to be disrespectful, but she wasn't a terrific actress. She was beautiful to look at.
She, I thought she was funny in The Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
She did a good job, but yeah. I don't think she was still growing and maturing as an actress.
Right. I mean, Valley of the Dolls, she was terrific. She was really good as a bad actress. There, I said it. I mean, but I'm not saying that to be funny. That's just the way, but anyway, so. Allison's mom, she said she didn't care anything about publicity. She doesn't need it at all. But she remembered doing this. So Eye of the Devil was dubbed. And she said there was never credit done. There was never any credit given. But she said she went back and listened to it. And she's 100% positive that her mother dubbed Sharon's accent in Eye of the Devil.
Wow.
So it's just another one of those weird, Nellie Olson has a degree of separation to, you know, Sharon.
Was she supposed to be up at the house that night?
Oh my God!
we'll get into that. So this is a crazy one that you and I have both been close to all along, for years now. The Hollywood Ripper was just found guilty, finally, of the two murders that he committed and an attempted murder. These murders go back almost two decades now. The first one was in 2001. So we covered this story when we did the E special.
Death Trip.
Hollywood called, Hollywood Death Trip. The crazy thing was, the first one was Ashley Ellerin, and that was the craziest and most brutal of the murders, and the most famous because there was an Ashton Kutcher connection to the whole thing.
Right.
And what was that, Scott?
Well, I mean, you know, here's something, Mike. Here's something, Mike.
Yeah,
do you think that we'd be talking about this today if it wasn't for Ashton Kutcher's involvement?
No.
I don't think so either.
No, I don't think you would.
And Ashton Kutcher was only there for a minute. He had a date with her post-Grammy party, so 11:30 p.m. pickup.
He's supposed to pick her up and take her out.
Yeah. So she didn't answer the door. He looked in and saw what he thought was spilled red wine and left.
Yeah.
And then she's found the next morning by her roommate, and brutal. I mean, brutal. Like, Sharon Tate had nothing on what happened to this chick.
Yeah, and I mean, she bled out so much that there was, like, no color
there was
left
nothing.
In her, basically.
It's like, oh. But what made it interesting is that she had just spoken to her landlord 30 minutes prior to Ashton Kutcher showing up. So she was murdered within that 30-minute time period. So technically...
I mean, the killer could have still been even in the house.
It could have been Ashton Kutcher.
Wow, it could have been Ashton Kutcher. That's really wild.
There is that.
Yeah.
But so
and this guy, this Hollywood Ripper guy, he was, what's his name? It was
Michael Gargiulo.
Michael Gargiulo, yeah. He's currently 43 years old, obviously, you know, in his 20s probably back then when this all happened. He had a deal, he was just, I guess, a psychopath, and he would get obsessive with a girl, and then he would ultimately kill her.
Right. We don't have to say allegedly anymore because he's done.
Convicted, yeah.
And he's probably going to be gone back to Illinois because there was that other woman that,
crazy.
That he supposedly allegedly
maybe
killed back
way
there.
Earlier even, I think, or something, right? Yeah.
But yeah, he's psycho, total psycho stalker.
Mm-hmm.
It was fascinating listening to her roommate and her best friend talking about her. It's on YouTube. Death Trip is on YouTube.
You should,
if you haven't watched it, that section alone is pretty interesting. Poor Ashley Ellerin.
Yeah, and she was described sometimes as Ashton Kutcher's girlfriend. It wasn't a real relationship. I think they'd just gone out a few times.
And by all accounts, a very nice person. So.
And killed right behind the Chinese Theater where she lived.
Her window, if you look outside her window, you'd be able to see the gymnasium from Back to the Future.
That's
outside
right.
Outside her window.
The Enchantment Under the Sea.
Oh, and here's something right? that's weird. Okay, you remember them yelling at us that night in Nashville?
I wasn't there. I just heard about it.
Because they came out of their car. They brought their car and they pointed it at us so
the
we couldn't shoot the
which
house.
Which was very smart.
But one of the persons that was working on it was Elliot Schwartz, who was Sherwood Schwartz's grandson.
Yeah, and we've
grandson.
Talked about him before. But yeah.
So he, you know, they were screaming, Elliot, we want to talk to Elliot.
Really?
Yeah. So, but anyways, it's cut to about 3 weeks ago. Elliot's mother was in the original Helter Skelter 1976. Movie, and she came into the shop. She was doing a little autograph signing with a couple of the other girls from. So Elliot's mother was in the Helter Skelter
so
movie.
So if you haven't listened to all of our episodes, we talked about him when we did the Gilligan's Island because Elliot Schwartz was Sherwood Schwartz's grandson.
Right.
And he was a production assistant on Hollywood
what
Death
a
Trip.
Elliot, if you're listening, hey.
An incredibly nice guy.
Yeah,
yes.
And Josh's friend. Yeah, they were terrific. I really enjoyed hanging out with those guys for the week.
Mm-hmm.
Another degree of Helter Skelter.
Another degree of connection, exactly. Another thing here, this is just a weird story, not a celebrity story, but a weird one that I know you heard about, Scott. This guy that was found behind the coolers at the grocery store in Council Bluffs,
I don't think I
Iowa.
Know this.
So a guy, he went missing in 2009. He stormed out of his parents' house. He was 25. He may have been becoming schizophrenic. He seemed to have all the hallmarks of it, but they hadn't really diagnosed him yet. They had just, like, the day before, I think, gone into a doctor and put him on antidepressants, and they didn't really work. And he was having paranoid delusions that people were following him, the usual stuff. And it was a snowstorm. It was November 28th of 2009 in Iowa, and he went out into the snowstorm and with no shoes and socks on, no keys, no car, and just disappeared. So his parents reported him missing, and for over 10 years, or almost 10 years, nothing. And so he worked at a grocery store called the No Frills Supermarket in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and that store went out of business 3 years ago, and apparently has just been sitting there. And so some contract workers were in the store recently, and they were tearing it all down. They were tearing down the shelves, and they were taking these big, you know, refrigeration units out, and they found what was left of him behind one of the refrigeration units.
This is the first I heard of that.
Yeah,
one.
And he. So what happened
what
was,
the hell, you know, what kind of store is that? They don't smell that.
That's the number one question. Everybody is the question his dad is asking. Everybody's wondering because they could understand that what happened was it was about a 12-foot drop off the back of these things. There was about an 18-inch gap between the coolers and the wall. At the back.
Oh, because one of those big, like those gigantic, like milk and dairy
exactly.
products things.
One of those type things.
Okay.
And they said that it was an area that was used for storage. They would store stuff up on top, and a lot of times the employees would climb up there if they wanted to take an unauthorized break. They could kind of hide up there. And so it was a regular kind of hangout spot, I guess, for employees to go up and hang, take a quick break. And they think he went into the store, and employees could come and go even if they weren't on shift. And I think he walked in and climbed up there and then fell behind, and maybe the sound of the coolers muffled him, you know, asking for help, or maybe he was incapacitated.
And nobody ever went back there for a nap ever again because they would have seen him.
That's the weird. Well, or, you know, it was a 12-foot gap, which is essentially a story, a floor of a, you know, when you think about that, that's floor to the ceiling is about 10 to 12 feet. So it might have just been so dark in that gap that nobody ever looked down there and could see. Unless you used a flashlight, I guess, you wouldn't have seen it. But you had to have smelled
it.
There
are too many.
You had to have smelled it. I really want to talk to some of the employees and have them be like, oh, yeah, there was a bad smell there for a few months and nobody knew what it was.
Especially if you open up the coolers. I mean, they have to have ventilation.
And also, especially with a grocery store. with health inspections and stuff like
right.
that.
Something's
it's
not
very
right.
Very weird. But they said that, you know, the autopsy, no obvious signs of foul play. And he was wearing the same clothes that he was reported missing in, so...
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, it sounds like an accident, but still, there's some, yeah. What? Come on.
I know. Oh, this is a big story of someone we both know, Anna Manson related. The La Bianca house went on sale
mm-hmm.
last month, mm-hmm. or a few weeks ago, to kind of coincide with the Manson film coming out. The La Biancas being the middle-aged couple that were murdered the next night.
Not
after
their
the
middle-aged, Mike.
Well, that's a good point. the couple who were murdered at the end of their lives.
Yeah, the older couple.
The next the day after the tapes yeah. and everybody else were murdered, the Mansons killed this couple. And that house went up for sale, and Zach Bagans of Ghost Adventures bought the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I edited and produced his movie Demon House, which mm-hmm. came out a year and a half ago. And so I kind of had a heads up about it, but I was really excited to hear, and I'm interested in seeing what he does with it, I guess. Mm-hmm. Although I know it was controversial when a lot of people heard about it, they weren't super excited. But
well, I mean,
he at least is owned by somebody who gets it.
I know, exactly, which means we will have access to it. I am 100% sure that we will be able to see it, because it's an investment.
No doubt.
He would never buy it unless there was a return.
I mean, it was almost $2 million.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I was really happy when I heard he got it, mm-hmm. because I know that it won't be torn down now. Because the house is in really bad shape.
It won't be remodeled. It won't be torn down.
It needs to be put back. I mean, the house is really, it needs
help.
Yeah,
I'd like to see it restored. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad that it will not be gone. That makes me very happy.
It's time for the main feature.
So before we dive headlong into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you got a article on the Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah.
Just about you, which is pretty wild.
I know. It was supposed to be about the house, but it turned out to be about me,
So for people who don't know, we've kind of hinted at it and said it, I guess, outright. Scott was a consultant on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's credited in the end credits and the special thanks.
And
he was involved in the making of that film. And then the Hollywood Reporter wrote an whole article about how Tarantino turned to this, what they call a tour guide, as his one of his main historical consultants.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a little piece about the original house. And I told the reporter.
About the Tate house?
Yeah.
The Cielo Drive house?
No one's really talked about the saga afterwards, you know, about how Altobelli lived up there and then he was renting it out and then the two brothers bought the place and et cetera.
The
Weintraubs, and then they sold it to Franklin.
That's what I meant, yeah.
But it was 14 years empty, so that's what I thought he was going to go with. But then it was like, yeah, it was all about me. So it was wild. But
yeah, I mean, our movie got a mention and everything.
Mm-hmm,
it was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very, very cool. And so, I mean, you know, I'm riding high on this big time. I mean, this is like career highlight, one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my life. And it was all very organic. And it's down to our little film that we made, you know, 10 years ago.
Yep.
And
so how did it start?
Well, I have a little cabinet in the shop now that's devoted to the movie. It's all you have to say anymore. It's the movie.
The movie. And, it's the only movie. Yes.
And I have a little frame with my first tweet, with my first little text message saying Quentin Tarantino's people called and they want to meet with you. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of neat. And then
but they called the shop?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So I thought that it was going to be a meeting with a dozen people, you know, and I thought it might be an intro to him. And it ended up being, you know, one or two other people. And then they ushered me into his office and introduced me and just shut the door. So it was like him and me. Our movie was on his desk, which was a real kick. And they shut the, and it was just him and me talking about the case. And he said this. He pointed to the movie. He goes, "This is what I want. This is exactly what I want."
So he pointed at the 6 degrees of Helter Skelter.
It's sitting on his desk. There's nothing else on his desk. But
and you,
like,
so you were like psyched right away. You're like, oh, wow, okay.
So we talked all about everything, really, about the case, about the myth of Helter Skelter or how that's sort of been blown out of proportion. We talked about the girls. We talked about the house. We talked about, you know, Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring. And as I was leaving, I'm trying to think of other things that came about during that meeting. But as I was leaving, he said, what's really important is that I want to bring 1969 back to Los Angeles. And it was February, so I was wearing my heavy jacket. And I go, I got to show you this. And I took off my jacket and I showed him my forearm. And I have this 1969 tattoo. Because everything, you know, wonderful and everything horrible happened that year.
It was a crazy,
yeah. So I showed him, I go, check this out. And I showed him my tattoo. He goes, you're the guy. So it was cool because he was sincere. And we sincerely got on. I was expecting him to be a bit... dude, you know, and it wasn't like that. It was really, it's just really cool and very interested.
Yeah.
So a few days later, I took him and his staff on a tour of basically the location. So I took him up to Cielo. We stopped at the bottom of the hill and walked up the hill. And he was pointing at, he was saying, well, Rick, now we know it's Rick Dalton. I didn't know it was just the character Rick at that point. He says, this is where Rick's house is going to be, pointing to the Cott house up there. And, clearly there's not much left up there. There's a couple of houses that were there, but almost everything else is gone.
Yeah.
So we got out, and walked around up there, and we got back out down Cielo Drive and walked around down there and just sort of, and then I introduced him to my friends who we interviewed for the Sebring house.
Really?
Yeah. So I drove him up Eastern Drive, and I called them while I was on the phone while I was in the car with Tarantino and those guys. I called my friends, and they let us in. And so we're walking all over the place. It was kind of funny. I said to Doctor, I don't want to say his name, but I said to him, I said, I got a friend with me and a couple of friends. Do you mind if we come up and check out the house? He's always so nice.
You didn't tell him you had Quentin Tarantino with you?
No. And he's not a starstruck guy, but it was just kind of like, oh, all right.
He's an older gentleman. Yeah.
Yeah. So we basically cruised around the whole house from the roof down to the pool to everything else.
Did you go inside?
Never.
No one's ever going to go inside that house until they're gone.
Yeah. They're very private people.
Yeah.
So anyway, by the time we left, they said they were talking to me in the bus. They're saying, well, do you think you'd be interested? Because he was pointing out where the hot tub would be, et cetera.
Mm.
And he said, do you think they'd do it? I said, I don't know. I don't know.
They let us film there for our film and walk all around, but that's a different deal. Yeah, it was not 100 people descending
on semis and the whole bit.
Right.
So I
really narrow canyon street and all that,
So I called them the next day and I asked them if it's okay to pass on their telephone information to Tarantino's people, and they set it up. They made a deal with them that they'd restore the pool, they'd work on the facade, fix it all up to make it look like Sebring lived there.
And probably got them a decent location fee for letting them film there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the house, I was up there a couple of weeks ago and had a good look at it, and it looked really good. It looked really good because the pool was, they've had some problems with the pool and the filtration, and now it looks pristine.
Wow. So, and you got a great photo with Tarantino on that big, that grand walkway that takes you into the house. Yeah.
The same place Sharon Tate had that picture with the house. So
and the
cool.
same place we filmed from.
That's right.
When we did 6 Degrees. Because it's really the view of the house is from that. There's this long side, because the house is set way back from the road. And there's a really long driveway, and there's a long walkway, a sidewalk, kind of with some steps that you take in. And that really is the view of the house. When you come down this walkway, you see the pool in front of the house and everything. It's kind of the grand view.
Yeah, because originally when Sebring lived there, you'd park with a garage like 4 or 5 houses off Eastern Drive, and then you'd walk up a staircase. Well, the people that owned the house bought a couple of other properties and moved the front gates to about 8 more pieces of property up above. So you would park up there, and then you would enter the property from above. And that's the spectacular view. From below is pretty cool. But when you walk up there and come down that cool stone staircase.
So people that don't know, the house is this Bavarian-style mansion that was built by Paul Byrne, who was a producer at MGM back in the early days, and back in the 20s and 30s. And I've been reading this biography on Irving Thalberg called Irving Thalberg, Boy Wonder to Producer Prince. Irving Thalberg was the creative head of MGM at the beginning, from the very, very beginning. And he, if you've watched the series The Last Tycoon on Amazon, which only aired for like, I think, a season. But it was cool. It basically, the main character in that is heavily based on Irving Thalberg. So Paul Byrne was Irving Thalberg's kind of one of his main producers, and Irving Thalberg was born with a heart condition and wasn't expected to live past like his 20s, and he ended up living longer than that. But he always had mortality on his mind, and Paul Byrne was the guy he thought was going to take over the reins for him at MGM, and instead Byrne gets involved in this relationship with Gene Harlow. And he had a estranged wife that was had mental problems, and it was just this big problem. And also he had what was described as undersized genitalia.
I think that's an urban myth.
It's in the book, and it's pretty well researched. For what it's worth, it's well researched.
All right. I don't know. So much of that's been blown out of proportion.
The autopsy inquest into it said that it was, I mean, he quoted, like, I think he got quoted the doctor.
They don't talk about dick size on autopsies. I mean,
they noted the organs and stuff, and they said that it was
undersized. He has a 5-inch dick. I mean, how do they know? I mean, they couldn't possibly know.
I don't know, but it was, this seems like a very well-researched book.
Okay,
so
I mean, I'm just saying that.
It has a really great account of his death and what happened, what happened the day of and all that, you know, who was in and out and all that stuff and how, this was an era when if someone like that died, they didn't call the police. They called the studio.
Right.
And Thalberg went down there and met with everybody, and it was a whole hour before they called the police.
Of course.
Because it was about protect the girl. You know, don't worry, he's dead. Protect Jean Harlow's reputation because she's the starlet of MGM.
She's the money.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We got to keep her reputation intact. And at first, that great suicide note that he left, I think Mayer put it in his pocket and wasn't going to let him. And then the other people at the scene convinced him to leave it behind and let the police find it. But that's just how things were done back then.
Yeah.
And there's other many, many, many other examples from Hollywood history from that era.
But basically,
Hollywood film studios really ran the city.
Yeah.
You know?
And Byrne ended up with a bullet in his head in Benedict Canyon.
Right.
Another notch in the curse of Benedict Canyon because J.C. Sebring owned the house.
So he built the house, and then J.C. Sebring eventually owned the house.
Yeah,
and Sebring painted it all crazy colors inside, right?
Yeah,
and
according
stuff,
to our
very
friends,
60s.
It's like purple rooms and stuff. In fact, in the trailer, they show just there's a lot of things that didn't end up in the movie.
Yeah,
and the trailer shows chop chop chop, just like a quarter of a second of Jay in his house listening to the stereo, and the walls are purple.
Oh, there you go.
So, and then they show that scene with him doing karate with Bruce Lee that's down by the pool. So that stuff is all going to end up somewhere.
And famously, Sharon Tate lived there with him for the year that they were engaged.
Oh,
and
had
the crazy nightmare and the premonition that supposedly, right?
There was a secret bar. There is a secret bar in there, that's for sure.
Yeah, but she supposedly had the premonition about the woman bleeding tied to the banister with her slit.
That came out after the murder.
Yeah, so who knows? You don't know if that was real or not, obviously.
But I had friends my friend, her name was Cass, who worked as a waitress at the Formosa back in the 90s when I used to hang out there. Her daughter was Cammy Sebring, who was Jay Sebring's wife, and lived in that house with Jay, and then they divorced, and that's when he started seeing Sharon.
Oh, wow.
So it's just kind of a weird, again, the Formosa, because the only reason I started going to the Formosa is because I heard somebody that was there was related to Jay Sebring. It's back in 94.
So you went to the Formosa before it was cool, right?
The ceiling tiles were falling down, you could still smoke, but I walked in, and I said, does somebody here know Jay Sebring? And Cass says, oh, see, he was married to my daughter. So we got along great. She'd bring in pictures of him and stuff. She was really, really nice. But she told me about the secret bar that Sharon Tate supposedly stumbled on when she saw this.
Because it was built during Prohibition, right? The Prohibition era,
yeah.
So it had the secret bar behind the bookshelf or whatever situation, painting or whatever it was,
So then, I introduced them to our friends. They used it for the movie, and after that, I took him back to the office, and that was really about it. I did gift him with a bottle of cologne that day, and it was a bottle of High Karate cologne, which was big in the '60s.
That's hilarious.
And do you ever see the commercials for that? You put it on. And you have to karate chop all the women off.
No, but it's funny because the soundtrack for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is incredible, and everybody go buy that soundtrack. Because it's not just a great mix of songs. It's actual L.A. radio station broadcasts.
Yeah.
And the DJ promoting things and commercials.
If you put your iPhone
in. And there's a cologne
commercial
in it, too.
Yeah,
but it's not
that
one. It's a different one. But, yeah.
He did say to me that they licensed that commercial to use in the movie. Or he was going to. So maybe it'll show up in the extended version.
Yeah.
But you're talking about the soundtrack. Here's something. I was at the office at the shop, and I was walking home, and I was listening to the soundtrack on my iPhone. And I was thinking, holy shit, this is like AM radio.
Yeah.
I used to carry my transistor radio in my pocket, and that's the way it's mono with radio announcements, just like it was in the 60s.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
They got like a mono recording of Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's been my go-to when I walk around L.A. a lot.
Yeah.
I've been listening to it on my my ear pods a lot.
It is just jumping back in time. And I still listen to my transistor radio at home, but it was like, I just realized it when I was listening to it on my way home. I was like, this is what he meant. This is you're carrying a transistor radio in your pocket again. It's so cool.
So then when production rolled around, you were on set a bit.
A few times, yeah.
And one of the interesting things was you were there. They shot at Sebring's actual salon.
Yeah.
The actual location on Fairfax where it existed in real life. And you got to go there and you met
Emil Hirsch,
who played Jay Sebring. And
yeah. That was wild. Yeah,
but it's crazy. That's one thing that's not in the movie.
Yeah. So, well, the house is not used and the Sebring salon. So,
but
I
they shot there like all day. So they shot something substantial there. It wasn't a quick shot.
Well,
like,
I mean, they set it up for like a week. You know, it was the facade was up there for like an entire week. Mm-hmm. So they paid money for that place.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the newsstand across the street, the magazines were put back. Every car in the farthest part of the lot was 50s and 60s car. But I did. I was just in front. I wasn't there in any capacity. I was just wanted to check it out, and I was taking some pictures. And I saw one of the crew guys, and I asked if Bill Clark was around. Bill Clark was the on the movie. he's like Tarantino's right hand man. He's there on every single shoot all the time. He's kind of dressed a little Miami Vice-ish. And in fact, he was there when we talked to him.
Yeah.
So, but you know, he said, "Yeah, why don't you come back and say hey to Quentin?" Or he said, "Q." And I'm like, "Okay,
Q, really?
Q, I swear, but not in a dicky way." And that's just so LA. But
yeah.
So I went back and Margot Robbie was back there and Sebring. Well, I didn't see Emil Hirsch, but I saw Margot Robbie and Tarantino was there. And he goes, hey, man. And I just said hello and I just asked if I could take some pictures of the outside. And then he pulled me aside and he asked me, he said, "I got to ask you something." He goes, "What was the name of the book Abigail Folger was reading in the movie?" Or in real life. What, when she was in bed, what book was she reading? So I told him. And it was Madame Bovary, and so that's what showed up in the movie.
Yeah, and you also told him about a couple of songs, and then the trailer came out, right?
Yeah, both of those. Well, because I met Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders a few years ago, and Mark Lindsay lived on Cielo Drive with Terry Melcher, the producer, who knew Manson.
Yeah.
That's why Manson knew the house. Then Mark Lindsay moved out, Candace Bergen moved in, then they both moved out, and that's when Sharon and Roman moved in. But Mark Lindsay told me that he and Terry Melcher composed Him or Me and Good Times on the piano in the room, and the house is furnished.
Yeah.
So the same couch that Terry Melcher was sitting on is the same sofa that Sharon Tate was murdered on.
Right.
And so the piano was just a few feet from that, and those two amazingly cool songs ended up, you know, coming out of an instrument that was just a few feet away from one of the most horrific crimes in American history. So it's sort of a weird pop culture reference, and that's exactly the kind of stuff he grooved on, you know? He wanted to know what the sheet music was on the piano.
Straight Shooter.
So, yeah, Straight Shooter and Pomp and Circumstance.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if Abigail Folger ever really sang. I think he might have taken some artistic liberties with that. But
he wanted to do something around the piano, so it makes sense, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But then the two songs you told him about ended up in the trailer.
Yeah.
And then how did you feel when you saw that in a
trailer? Well, I mean, it's a fucking kick in the pants. I mean, you're like, I know that came from me. You know, I just it was February a year ago. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even close to, but there was still location shooting.
Yeah.
So our location scouting.
Yeah.
And then when we were talking about 9069 again in the bus, and one of the women that was in there, and I feel like I'm being insulting by not knowing their names, but they said they're going to put some of the Sunset Strip back. I go, "Oh my God, like, did you see the Doris movie?" She's like, "I did that."
You could say I saw that, yeah. I mean, when you're Tarantino, you go and get the best people for each position.
Yeah, and you know, like with me, they could have found a researcher and tapped away and found everything that I had.
Found some USC professor or something like that or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, so that was really cool. And then I was on, well, you were with me when we went to the El Coyote.
Yeah, so we all, you and Allison Martino of Vintage Los Angeles were following this shoot very, very, very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And we were almost like groupies to some extent of the production, you know?
Very much.
Because because you could drive around LA and see the buildings getting transformed. It wasn't done digitally. He actually repainted, you know, Pandora's Box and these other places to look like they did back in the day. So when they filmed at El Coyote, you know, that's not far from me. I had to go down there, of course. So, and I knew you were going to be down there. So I went down and you and I ended up standing in front of the El Coyote while they were filming, and the old cars were all on the street.
Oh, man.
And then Tarantino walked by and stopped and saw us and talked to us for a couple minutes. I remember he had this crazy pipe.
Yeah, the
like
Sherlock Holmes pipe.
Big Sherlock Holmes pipe that he was walking around with. It wasn't lit.
No.
I don't think he was just carrying it around.
It was all on Hollywood Boulevard like that, too.
It was wild. Whatever, man. He can do what he wants. But he stopped and talked to us for a second, and I remember from my place, I could see the Klieg lights that were coming up from Beverly Boulevard down the street at his New Beverly theater that he owns. Yeah. He owns a little independent theater on Beverly, which is just a few blocks down from where the El Coyote is. And for those of you who don't know, the El Coyote is their actual, it's a Mexican food restaurant that still exists. It's still very popular, where Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring and them ate their last meal the night they were murdered. So he actually filmed at the actual place where that happened. And so he stopped us and he started telling us, oh yeah, he goes, I looked up because, of course, you know, I wanted to find out if anything was going on at my movie theater
that I now own. You know what he said? I'm going to tell you how
it went down.
He said, he walked over and he says, so what's going on over there? And I said, well, that's your theater. He goes, yeah, but what's going on over there? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
He goes, well, the night of the murders, they were premiering a movie there called A Man and a Woman.
And it was an adult movie theater.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, the way they got away was showing, it was about making a baby. That's how it was educational.
Yeah, and there was a live birth in it, so they couldn't,
So, but anyway, he said, yeah, they were premiering at that. And I go, you're kidding me. I said, I mean, I thought I knew everything. I was looking up phone books. I was looking up what was on TV. And I never looked that one up. And he said, so in the movie, I'm just going to have Sharon just looking at it and go, oh, what's going on over there? And that's, and
she does.
Up.
And she does. Yeah, it's in the film. Yeah.
So,
she was like, what would they be, you know, premiering at the nudie,
at the dirty movie
dirty
theater.
Theater?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. That was pretty. And it showed up. I mean, we're witness. We were there.
Yes.
We were both there at the same time. But it was cool. And then walking over there and seeing that yellow Camaro pull up and watch those four people representing those four people that I've been studying for so long. And, you know, Jay is wearing what he was murdered in, Emil Hirsch, and the guy who played Wojciech was wearing what he was murdered in.
They did a great job with the costumes, yeah.
Shit, that was, I mean, I still get chills. I got chills just thinking about it. All those parking meters, all those extras, and you just hear him say, you know, rolling, and it was like, boom, all of a sudden, we have just time traveled to my favorite time. It was like nothing else.
And right after we talked to QT, I looked over in the driveway there in the parking lot, and I saw somebody I know, which is his name's Leonard Jefferson, and he was the car captain on the production.
Oh, yeah.
He was in charge of getting all those cool kick-ass cars for the production. And Leonard Jefferson, I know because he took the last photo ever taken of Tupac Shakur literally a minute before he was fatally shot in Las Vegas.
I know that photo. It's iconic.
It's one of the most famous celebrity photos ever taken of Tupac sitting in the car next to Suge Knight. Suge Knight's driving, and Tupac's looking right at the camera, and he got shot like 60 seconds later. And I know the whole story of that was just Leonard had met Tupac before. They kind of were acquaintances, and Leonard Jefferson was there for Fight Night like everybody else was, Tyson Fight Night in Vegas in the 90s was like Super Bowl weekend. And he goes, I was driving down the strip. I was on my way to California Pizza Kitchen to get some food. And I look over and there's Tupac. And I went, hey. And he looked at me and remembered me. He goes, hey. And he goes, hey, come to the club. You know, we're going to this club down the street. We're going to perform. And he's like, okay. And he goes, I always kept a little camera in my center console in my car. So I took the camera out. And I looked at him. I was like, can I get a picture? And he was like, yeah. And I snapped this photo of him. I always thought it was a professional picture camera, you know, professional photo, but it's not. It was just a little point and shoot camera, and it ended up being one of the most famous photos ever taken of anybody. And then he was in the entourage, you know, several cars back when the shooting happened. He heard the shots and all that, and that unfolded. But he's a professional car captain in the business. He's worked on all kinds of stuff. He's worked on Fast and the Furious movies and stuff. And for those of you who don't know, car captain is in charge of the cars, the picture cars, the cars that are actually going to appear on screen. He rounds up the cars, and then he's there on set to make sure everything goes smoothly and to direct the drivers and where to go and place the cars and all that stuff, which was a big part of this movie because it was so period.
Every
car had to be brought in.
There were buses in Old City. Were
it
you there?
Bus, when
were
it backed you? Into the car?
Oh, my God. Oh, and everybody, you just hear a collective moan.
I hung out across the street with, randomly, I looked over and Rodney on the Rock, one of the most famous, was sitting there by himself. And I went over and I said, are you Rodney? I mean, he's got a very unique look. And he's like, yeah, and he was very friendly. And I talked to him, and then Allison Martino showed up. Mm-hmm. So the three of us stood across the street and watched this. And I went over and started talking to the extras that were driving the cars.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing that, because they would... The cars would drive down the street and then they'd go cut, and all the cars didn't have to go in reverse and back up and get back into place. And the person driving the bus, you know, limited visibility, backed into one of the picture cars.
Everybody there was just like, oh.
That's bad.
Yeah.
So that's bad.
And you know, the reason they didn't use the real Manson car, which is owned by a friend of mine, the 59 Ford.
The actual car that they drove that night.
Yeah, they wouldn't. The man who owns it, who it's for sale, by the way, but it's going to be
for like $1 million, yeah. Probably. Yeah.
But he wouldn't. They wouldn't insure it. And also, they wanted to modify it. They wanted to mount things on it.
Right,
you know?
He didn't want to damage it in any way.
Yeah, so they took the original car and they photographed every inch of it and recreated it exactly.
Amazing.
And I've seen the car several times, so I know I could tell. You know, I could tell it was not the real one.
Yeah,
but. It sounds like that was no reason for me to say that even out loud. But but even the point where Tex puts in the trailer, where Tex puts the gun on the seat, even the upholstery was right. It was crazy.
Amazing. So we are getting into spoiler territory. So I'm going to give you guys
Let me tell you about the El Coyote though. Real
okay,
quick.
Before so, I give you one more spoiler warning, Scott's going to tell us one more story about the El Coyote.
And I got to tell you about seeing this movie at the Cinerama too.
Oh hell yes.
So we're at the El Coyote the other night, and Allison was there. They were sitting in the booth they call the Sharon Tate booth, which really nobody
knows. Which is different
knows.
From the one that's in the movie.
Yeah. Completely different section.
Yeah.
But we were in the way back with about 60 other people, and Allison comes over, and she says, "You're not going to fucking believe this." She didn't say fuck. She says, "You're not going to believe this." She goes, "Jane Fonda just sat down at my table with her dog." This is the night of August 8th, the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders. And she says that she's there with Diane Warren, the songwriter. She's there with Lorraine Newman. And she goes, "Jane Fonda just come in." She goes, "I'm crashing this party. I want to sit here because my friend Sharon sat here 50 years ago." And Jane Fonda sat down at their table with her fucking dog.
At the actual, real one by the bathrooms that everybody accepts as the truth. Yeah.
So everyone from our party is going to cheer. Jane Fonda's over there. You know? So they're all going. And Jane's out in front for a while. And Jane is posing for pictures with every single person that comes up to her.
Amazing.
Every single person. So
did
Troy.
Did she register under Sebring?
No. So Troy and my friend Donna were outside, and Jane was over there posing for pictures. And then she was alone for a half a second, and Troy and Donna went up to her and said, "Jane, we don't want to bother you or anything. We don't want a picture or anything. We just want to say we really like you. We really love you." And she goes, okay. And then she just turned and walked away. Troy and Donna are like, dying, you know, they're like clutching their chest. She's oblivious, Jane Fonda, but it was like the best thing to get dissed by Jane Fonda.
Yes.
My mom
had her workout VHS videos in the 80s when I was growing up.
Which made her more money than Peter Fonda. I mean, I'm sorry, Henry Fonda, certainly.
Yeah.
Another one. But who lived in the guest house, they say? Henry Fonda, they say, lived in the guest house on Cielo Drive. He certainly,
one that William Gerritsen was in the night of?
He talks about being, in his biography, he talks about, I wrote down the quote.
Because that was built back in the 40s, I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so he had been there because he mentions the young man who was killed in that very place in his biography.
Stephen Parent, yeah.
Yeah, so... Henry Fonda, another degree of separation.
Okay, so we're going to dive pretty hard into the plot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So this is your final spoiler alert warning.
Mm-hmm.
Don't blame us if we ruin the movie for you. Because you had every opportunity to see it, and if you haven't seen it yet, then how much do you really care?
I mean, people I know have seen it like 6-7 times now.
I've seen it twice in the Cinerama Dome, and I plan on seeing it. I want to see it at New Beverly.
Yeah, I saw it there the other day.
Before, because he's selling like the old candy too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I have to do. I hope it's still. I think it's still going on, and I need to do that before it leaves. Which New Beverly is the theater that Tarantino owns, and he apparently had to kind of do some special jumping through the hoops thing because that theater is not authorized to show first run films.
Yeah.
So,
and here's a tip for you, because people, they've been selling tickets in advance and they've sold out for like a month. But if you go during the week, there's always people that bought tickets that don't show up. So you can always get standby tickets.
I've seen the line for the standby in other films before too, because I saw one of the spaghetti westerns there. A few weeks ago or a couple months ago.
They do have a couple. They have the Cielo street signs in the lobby, and they have the Rick Dalton posters there from the movie. So
amazing.
It's and he hand procured, you know, it's 35 millimeter. They show real proper previews with the little dun 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 dun. You know, the previews are coming attractions.
The real ones, yeah.
Yeah, and they show the preview for, I don't know, maybe, we're spoiling it.
Yeah,
so.
Dude, we already gave the warning. Yeah. We're talking openly, but they did the great trail, the, what was the, the action movie.
CC and Company.
Yes.
And then and Rosemary's Baby. They showed the trailer for Rosemary's Baby.
That's
and,
great.
And it's 35 millimeter. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so good.
So I wanted to talk about you. So Rick Dalton is the Leonardo DiCaprio character.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of somewhat on the verge of being a washed up star. And then Cliff Booth, who's played by Brad Pitt, is his stunt man friend and best friend. And I read how this kind of all got started was, I think it was Inglourious Basterds, that when Tarantino was filming it, one of the actors on that set asked Tarantino if he could, there was some light action that this guy had to do, and this actor was like, hey, can I bring my stunt guy in for this? And Tarantino, it really wasn't necessary, but this guy was like, look, he's been my guy for many years, and I want to give him a day of work, basically. And Tarantino was like, all right. So they brought the guy in, and he did the stunt. And that was the first time Tarantino really locked in on, that's an interesting relationship that these actors have with their regular stunt guy that they work with for years and years and years and years, because they work well together, and there's kind of a lookalike between the two of them, and it's hard to find that, right?
Well, they say that, and I don't know enough about Westerns on television to be able to comment with you know, much authority, but as I understand it, it's based loosely on Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham, his own stunt man.
So this is a quick edit here by Mike. I have tried. I just spent like the last hour trying to find this article that I read where Tarantino told this story about this stunt man on the set of one of his movies, and I cannot find it. I read so many articles about this movie. I just cannot track it down. So maybe one of you guys can find it, but to Scott's point, of course, it was also based off of real people like Hal Needham. I think Steve McQueen's stuntman may have also served as some inspiration. There's several other of these other kind of famous stuntman actor relationships that inspired this movie, with Needham being the main one. So, grain of salt with my story, I guess. Anyways, back to Scott.
And Quentin Tarantino is named after Burt Reynolds' character in, I think it was Gunsmoke?
Yeah.
The Quentin.
Yeah.
Quint is his name on Gunsmoke, and I believe that's where his mom got Quentin from.
And he was originally supposed to play George Spawn.
Burt Reynolds was.
Burt Reynolds
right.
was originally cast.
I kept hoping he was going to show up.
I know.
That would have been really cool.
And I read recently, and this came from Tarantino himself, I think he heard from two or three different sources that Burt Reynolds was working on his lines for this film when he died. He was working on the lines, and then he took a break to go to the restroom and died. So he was like, the last thing he did was work on this script.
It's like a day of filming it could have been done, you know?
I know.
Scene with Bruce Dern is like, It's like
2 hours and you would have been in and out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, it's heartbreaking.
Bruce Dern was great in the role.
Yeah.
Of course. But yeah, it is heartbreaking. It could have been his last bit.
It would have been perfect.
Yeah.
Starting and ending with a cowboy thing.
Yeah. Oh, man. Anyway, that was my favorite part of the whole film.
Mine too.
Which I loved all of it. But the whole Spawn Ranch sequence was so perfectly executed. It's great tension. In filmmaking, it's like a masterclass on that, but it's all, I just love the way he recreated the family and everybody living out there.
It was chilling.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that when he was walking slowly up to Spawn's trailer, or to Spawn's little shack, that was nuts.
Yeah.
And, you know, the woman, who's the woman that plays the young girl that brings Brad Pitt to the ranch?
Yeah, the hitchhiking girl.
Yeah, that's Andy McDowell's daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and she should be nominated for something. She is
hell
of an actress.
Really great. Dakota Fanning was great as Squeaky, which was unrecognizable as Squeaky. And another famous daughter of famous people, the girl that played the kind of, well, her character was named Flower Child, but it was really based on Kasabian's character. That is Maya Hawke, who is Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke's daughter.
It's so weird.
And she's had a breakout summer because she also had a huge role in this third season of Stranger Things that just came out, and she was excellent in it. She had a major, major role in that series. So
it's bizarre because Uma Thurman, who did the whole Me Too, Quentin treated me like shit thing, and yet Uma's own daughter shows up in the movie. So there must be some sort of, you know, separation or some sort of coming to terms with something.
Or they patch things up. Because I remember when Emilio Estevez was going to be in The Outsiders, which was Coppola. Of course, his father, Martin Sheen, had had a famously horrible time with Coppola. And I read this kind of oral history of The Outsiders. And basically, they had to get Martin Sheen's okay for Emilio Estevez to work with Coppola again because of the horrible time Sheen had had on Apocalypse Now. So I, no doubt they had. I cannot imagine that Uma Thurman's daughter would go be in a movie with Tarantino had they not smoothed things over and hashed it out.
Yeah.
And the bigger thing, not just the Me Too thing, was the crash.
Well, I don't think Uma Thurman was in Tarantino. Well, it was the Weinstein thing with Tarantino.
That was the big
it
thing.
Wasn't Tarantino himself, but it was association with Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, but there was a different issue with Uma Thurman got into a car crash while making Kill Bill, and it was filmed. And she accused, I think, the producers of the film and her agency and everybody of covering it up when it happened.
Yeah.
And Tarantino, to his credit, ended up giving her that footage and said, you can release it if you want, and she did. She put it out on Instagram. Of her getting, and it was a pretty violent crash. She got a, you know, she hurt her knees. She had a concussion from it. The stunt coordinator had to run up and carry her out of the car. I mean, it was a really bad one. And they had told, you know, them that they need to have a stunt driver, and it had been refused, and they made her do it. And what I found interesting was there are two driving scenes in this movie that are shot from that same perspective, both driving fast, both Brad Pitt driving the Carmen Ghia down Cielo and doing the fishtail out onto the street. That shot from that same angle, that over-the-shoulders angle from the back seat, and then later on we see that angle again when Roman and Tate do that same drive.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting. I wondered if that wasn't
nothing
on
is
purpose.
Not contrived with him. Nothing.
Yeah. He,
there's nothing
it's
in that movie.
It's that same back seat looking forward angle.
I did that the other night too.
Just Thurman.
To
did you?
Yeah. No, we drove up there. We didn't go up on the anniversary. We went like a couple days later, and you know, we did exactly that.
I personally enjoyed watching Brad Pitt beat the shit out of Clem Grogan.
Yeah, that was satisfying.
I love that. And what's crazy, so Clem Grogan was one of the guys in the Manson family, and he was convicted for taking part in the murder of a guy named Shorty Shea, who was a ranch hand at the Spahn Ranch.
And he was a pedophile.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
And supposedly Charlie didn't like him, and there was made possible that Shorty Shea was going to rat them out or get them kicked off the ranch or whatever, and so they murdered him. So Clem Grogan went to prison for that, and then he ended up getting early release, in part because he showed authorities where the body was, because he'd never been found, and also because he was mentally deficient.
It just doesn't make sense.
So I wonder, though, since Clem Grogan is out, if he's seen the movie and watched Brad Pitt kick the shit out of him.
Yeah, you know they did. You know they did.
You know he probably wouldn't watch it, yeah. Because he's living, I think he's living up north, up
he's
in the northwest.
He's a performer. You can Google him. I mean, you can go see him live.
Oh, that's right. I think we talked about this. He was at one point the same prison as Bobby Beausoleil, another member of the Manson family convicted of murder, and who's also a musician. And they played in the same prison band together at one point. And you can find those recordings on YouTube. If you look at Bobby Beausoleil and Clem Grogan playing together.
It's bizarre. But yeah, you can go see. You can see Scramblehead live if you Google it.
Scramblehead, yeah. I didn't know that. That's wild. Oh, yeah. Man. So we talked about how, you know, our movie was an influence on the historical Manson side of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of things that jumped out to me. I feel like you and I probably watched this film on a different level than probably anybody else on the planet because of that connection. Also, before I get into that, I thought the whole Cliff Booth maybe murdering his wife on the boat was an obvious kind of sort of reference to Robert Wagner and Natalie Wood, almost. Not exact, of course, but I mean.
I guess they were there. They were on the scene at the time. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to pull from different parts of Hollywood history.
Yeah.
So, you know. Okay, so first of all, the first time we meet the Manson girls in the film, they're freegening. They're in dumpsters, dumpster diving for food. And what song are they singing? They're singing the actual Manson song, Always Is Always Forever, also sometimes referred to as I'll Never Say Never to Always, which is the same exact song that we used in our movie.
Yeah.
Of all the dozens of Manson recordings you could grab, you know, he had them sing that one, which I thought was interesting.
It's so haunting.
And we played at a haunting moment in the film, too.
And they were dumpster diving under that really cool portrait of James Dean on the side of that building, which they took away. I mean, they pointed it for the movie, and then they took it away away.
You think the building was like, no, keep it.
Yeah.
And one other interesting parallel I thought was interesting was that when the killers in the movie first go up the street and they're sitting out in front and Rick Dalton's, Leonardo DiCaprio's character comes out with the blender of booze and starts yelling at them, that was basically what happened in real life. It just happened down the block after the murders. when Tex and the girls pulled up in front of that guy's house and started washing off the blood in his driveway, and he came out and yelled at them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kids, you know, get out of here and whatever, and he not knowing what they had just done, you know, down up the canyon. And that's exactly what Rick Dalton's character does in this movie when he comes out and starts yelling at him, and he doesn't see the gun on the seat, you know.
There's a website called CieloDrive.com, and they have audio recordings.
It's fantastic.
The audio recordings of Rudolph Weber's interview, and he's the guy whose house they chose to hose off, which is what you're saying, is that he kind of represented that DiCaprio did in that scene. But Weber talks about how there's been hippies around here all the time. You know, this whole neighborhood is inundated. These empty houses up the street, hippies are always around here.
And we knew they were always walking around Laurel Canyon and all those canyons and stuff. So, And he was just fed up with it.
Like, yeah,
what are you kids up to? You know? Property. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the wife coming in, get the license plate number of the car. You know, it was. And then he reaches in to grab the car keys. I mean, that's mental. You know, not knowing they just slaughtered five people over there.
Yep.
But yeah, absolutely insane.
I also thought it was interesting that, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Pitt's character Cliff Booth picks up the Manson girl while she's hitchhiking, which is.
Almost exactly
like Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
He passed him once and then saw him again the second time. This instance, Booth sees her. It's a third time when he picks her up, but it's the same thing. I thought they covered Squeaky and Spawn's relationship, which, of course, we went into, and that's how she got her name.
Mm-hmm.
Was supposedly the name she would make when
she came out really recently. Said she didn't have sex with George Spawn. I'm like, yeah, right.
I mean, he had to be getting something for... out of the situation. Maybe it was just flirtatious. I don't know, but
those dirty, nasty girls. God, they're filthy. Oh, the feet. Oh,
the
my God.
Gross
the feet in the movie.
And, you know, and Tarantino has a heavily rumored foot fetish. And there's a lot of feet in the movie.
There's dirty, gross, bare feet in your face. It's so gross.
As we spoke about earlier, they filmed at J. Sebring's actual salon, which we showed in our movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting, too, that they kind of removed Manson from the film, which we also did largely. We didn't... Every documentary and everything that's made about the Manson family focuses on the cult of Manson and what a scary figure he was, and he's this almost iconic... evil person. And I mean, we didn't even put him on the cover of our movie. Later on, the distributor did, but we really left him out of it for the most part. It was more about everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it was about the victims and it was about the other members of the family.
Mm-hmm. That it will be featured, though.
We didn't sensationalize him, you know.
Yeah.
And that's in Manson only shows him, or Tarantino only showed him in one scene, which again is a scene that we talk about in our movie, which is when Manson actually showed up
at
Cielo Drive when Tate was living there looking for Terry Melcher, the music producer. And instead of it being Sharon's photographer that confronts him, in Tarantino's version, he had Jay Sebring's character confront him. But they saw each other, you know, Tate and Manson saw each other and all that. So
yeah, the guy that played him, Damon Harriman, he took my tour before when he was studying to do Mindhunter. He was cast as Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood after he was already signed to do Mindhunter.
So which just came out today, the new season.
Yeah.
Mindhunter, season two.
And I mean, he's a really nice guy. I posted a picture when it got announced that he was doing Manson in this movie, too. I posted it on Instagram, and he reached out to me right away. He goes, man, these people are pissed at me. They, you know, take it down.
Because
it was like, I figured it was fair game now that it's been announced.
Yeah, and it should have been.
But it wasn't. And he said, they're really mad at me. So will you please take it down? So I did, and I was able to put it back up again. But Damon Harriman got Manson background from me.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to be blowing my fucking horn forever on this one. This is like
deservedly,
the biggest thing.
Deservedly so.
It's freaking cool. Yeah, I was so starstruck the first time I saw it. And, you know, it was the first time it was shown. It was at the Cinerama Dome. And
it was the L.A. premiere, right?
Yeah. So there were about a dozen of us. Allison, Rodney was there. I had my friend Donna Lethal. My niece was there. And it was going to be the first time we saw the movie ever.
Yeah.
Terry Bolo. And so we sat at the beginning of it. So we're having drinks. They had these really cool cocktail glasses. Did they have those when you were there? They were Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like really nice glasses that you bought drinks in. And Tarantino goes to the bar. And I'm like, you know, Allison Martina comes, you go to the bar. right now. So I went in there, Tarantino's over there. So I just tapped him on the shoulder. And I said, he said, do you mind? I just want to get a drink. I'm like, cool, you know, I get it. I get it. And I said, I just want to, I hope you're wearing your high karate tonight. Uh-huh. And he turned around and go, oh, hey, man, how's it going, dude? You know, and it was all, that's all it was. But then, so we're watching the movie. It starts, and Troy and I both had a couple of drinks, okay? So 45 minutes into the movie, we get up to use the bathroom, you know? And I'm like, oh, okay, we're leaving the Cinerama Dome. The first time it's being shown in public, Tarantino's behind
us. And
you're
walking out.
We're walking out. And so I'm standing, so Troy and I are standing at the urinals, and I'm just, and I said just that. I said, this is the only time we're actually seeing a movie for the first time with the director behind us, and he sees us being rude.
Walk
the
out of his
The fucking door
movie.
Opens, and it was him in the fucking, he was in the fucking stall. And I'm like, it was Troy and me and Tarantino in the bathroom at the Cinerama. I'm like, hi, it's you. And he's like, you know, it was just the weirdest thing. I mean, I couldn't. And Troy is still standing there, so his back is turned. He doesn't know what's going on. And I'm talking to Tarantino. And he goes, hey, man, what do you think of the film? I'm like, what am I going to say? It's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says, yeah, well, he did say, this was just, I'm sure, awkward men's room conversation. But he says, I'm going to give you a call in a week or so. I want to find out what you think of it. I'm like, sure, you do, you know. But I mean, it was like, you know, what else is he going to say? But it was really cool. And it was just, and then he leaves them, walk up to Troy. Go, are you fucking kidding me? Do you know what you think? He said, it was fucking Tarantino. And Troy was like flipping. But it was like, it was such a weird, to be in the bathroom with Tarantino at the first screening of his movie was something else.
Wow.
It was meant to be. Me and Tarantino in the shitter. But he wasn't shitting.
Well, and speaking of meeting Tarantino, the only other time I ever met him was when I first moved to Los Angeles. And I went to work for a PR firm, and who was their number one client?
Well, let me guess.
Burt Reynolds.
Oh, really?
Yep.
How fun is that?
Yep. I worked for Burt Reynolds' publicist and got to meet Burt Reynolds on the Paramount lot for a special screening of Without a Paddle, unfortunately, the Seth Green comedy that kind of played a riff on Deliverance.
Oh,
so
okay.
They gave him a cameo in it. So I got to meet him. He was very nice. Burt Reynolds was very, very, very nice to me. And I went fanboy and started gushing about Boogie Nights. And he was like, yeah, I was a bitch getting it made. And, you know, and I'd say you should have won the Oscar. And, you know, he's like, yeah, I won the Golden Globe and, like, the New York Film Critics Award for it. So it was all right, and et cetera. And so anyway, so while I was working with that publicist, they also represented Michael Madsen.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the Kill Bill movies was coming out on DVD at the time, and literally, like, we're closing the office for the day, and out of nowhere, this the girl that was the office manager, she goes, hey, do you want... I was just an intern there. She goes, do you want to go to the Playboy Mansion? And I'm like 26 years old. Yes. Yes, I want to go to the Playboy Mansion. I'm like, hell yeah. She's like, yeah. She goes, we're on Michael Madsen's guest list for the, you know, the DVD premiere party for Kill Bill tonight. She goes, and I'm burned out on it, so you can go in my place if you want. I was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
So we went, and they had you park in a parking garage at the UCLA, which was nearby, and then they had buses going back and forth from that parking garage up the hill to the mansion. And it was me and a bunch of other dudes my age on this bus, and it was like we were going to Disneyland.
Yeah.
Like there was electricity in the air of excitement as we're rolling up. And then when the gate actually opens and you go through it, you're like, oh my God, this is actually happening. So that, you know, you pull into that big roundabout driveway there, and we went inside and we went into the yard. You couldn't go into the main mansion, but the whole yard area was all open. And so while I was there, did many cool things, but the coolest thing was eventually Tarantino actually showed up. He kind of was the last one to arrive, and he got mobbed, of course, and he was doing press interviews and stuff. And then people kind of left him alone, and I ran up to him, and I was like, Quentin. And he turned around, and he goes, yeah. And I stuck my head out, and I said, hey, I just want you to know, I'm a filmmaker, and you've been a big influence on me and my other filmmaking friends. And he was like genuinely like, oh, wow, like, thanks. And shook hands, and then I like got in and got out before it got weird, before I had my Jane Fonda moment.
Mm-hmm.
I got out of there. Well, that exact spot where we met is in the movie.
Oh, really?
When it was right by the near the pool and the grotto opening there on that kind of flagstone ground. And there's this big overhead crane tracking shot as you kind of get introduced to the mansion. And I could look down and see the exact spot where I stood with Tarantino, I don't know, 17 years ago, 16 years ago. So, yeah, I was really, I couldn't believe
that
it.
That is really cool.
So
the mansion's a lot smaller than it seems, doesn't it? When you drive up to it, it's sort of like, it's a lot, you'd think it'd be a lot, you expect it to be this big gothic manor.
Yeah.
But it really is pretty modest.
And they have a bunch of older-ish Playmates. Well, this was back when it was still the mansion.
Yeah.
It isn't anymore. But at the time, they were there doing tours. So you could go on a tour and, you know, miss whatever 1992 would, you know, lead you around.
Yeah.
And take you into the arcade area, the arcade and the place where the peacocks are, and kind of give you the history of the place. It was really cool.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it's funny because it was really a corporate event, but people went in the grotto and got crazy.
Of course.
And security had to go in there and throw everybody out at a certain point. And, yeah.
That was...
And then at a certain point, the Playmates got naked in the pool and swam naked in front of everybody. And
that was sort of disappointing. They didn't show any nudity in this movie at the play. You know, that was the one thing that stood out was that all the people in the pool, there were no boobs.
Right.
You know? And I know Bridget from The Girls Next Door. She's a friend of mine. And she... I asked her about the scenes because she lived at the mansion for years with Hefner. And she said that she liked it, but she said the one thing that she noticed, which is one of my favorite things, is when they walked in. And that scene is glorious.
Yeah.
When Roman and Sharon go to the Playboy Mansion and she's dancing with Mama Cass. That was just... But there's a scene where you see all the Playboy bunnies in the background doing the, not the frog, but I forget what they were doing, the jerk. They were doing the jerk because Tony Basil choreographed that.
Mm-hmm.
And Bridget said it was really good, but there were a lot of liberties taken, including that they didn't own the Playboy Mansion in 1969. Hefner didn't live there then.
Right.
But she said the bunnies would never have done that. They would never, have
done
participated and done a dance like that. That was just something that, it wasn't forbidden. It's just something that wasn't done.
Yeah.
So, you got to give it artistic freedom because he took a ton of pop culture references and stuck it in one place. And that's why I always sort of resented his movies in a way, because I felt like all the songs were my favorite songs, and I felt like, I felt like my brain had been picked watching his old movies because of the pop culture references. And these are the things I love the most, but I guess the things that you don't like about something are the things that are the most like yourself. You know, if you don't like somebody, it's usually because for some reason they remind you of you.
Maybe. Yeah.
And I think that might be part of it, because I sort of resented the attention being brought to the cool things that I liked.
Yeah.
But
they're kind of your personal things.
I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I thought so.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
The older I get, the more zen I am about it.
I love this movie. I feel like Quentin made a movie for Mike Dorsey. That's how I felt about watching this.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed like every frame of it.
Yeah.
I loved it so much. And we're going to talk about the ending now. So fair warning one more time, guys. So I loved how he turned the tables on the murders and exacted the brutality of the murders on the killers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
He took his greatest weapon, which is his brutal violence that Tarantino does in his movies, and he unleashed it on members of the Manson family instead of these innocent victims getting it. I loved it.
But what really surprised me, up until the moment we watched it, I thought it was going to end a different way.
And you didn't know what it was going to go. I thought for a while that when Brad Pitt walked away, I thought they were going to kill Dalton.
Yeah.
And then Pitt would maybe get blamed for it because he was on acid or something. I was like, I hope it doesn't go that way.
Well, because I knew that he wanted to know the murder scene. I know he wanted the name of the book that Abigail Folger was reading. So I know that they were going to demonstrate it up until the moment the murders happened.
Right.
I also know that Deborah Tate gave it her blessing, so that meant Sharon wasn't going to get murdered.
Right.
So I thought the whole thing was going to unfold that the victims, Sharon and Jay and those guys, fought back. So the whole thing about getting into Rick's house and Cliff and that just totally blew me away. And I think that surprised most everyone.
Yeah.
It's the way that happened, the way it turned about. And to see that, and also they mentioned in the beginning of it some spoilers that were, the press were asking Tarantino about the excessive violence towards women. It's like, okay, there's another one, so I know it's going to happen, but I just don't know how it's going to happen.
Right.
So,
you realize it's the Manson girls that the violence is going to be on, not Kate.
Yeah. And that was, and to see that awful, awful, brutal killing of those killers at that point. They weren't killers yet in the movie. But then people in the audience just cheering and whooping it up. And that was, and I just started thinking, 50 years coming. It's about time. Tex Watson and Susan Atkins and Carmichael got what they deserved.
Yes.
And it was really satisfying.
Yeah, totally.
And that, I'll tell you, though, the part that will always get me in that movie was when Rick Dalton's out there and the intercom, Jay Sebring is out there and the intercom comes on with Sharon's voice. That was devastating.
I read a review for somebody that said they started crying.
Yeah, I did too. I've seen it twice.
That innocent voice coming out over, like,
Jay, honey,
it's like, that's how it should have been.
Fuck. It really is moving. And I hope that anyone who hasn't seen the movie isn't listening to this, because that scene is so emotional, so wonderful to see. You know, those people, you know, everything okay down there? You know, and Sebring comes down the driveway.
What the hell happened, man? Yeah.
I still got chills just talking about this. But that intercom is devastating. It was just, you'd kind of wish that's what happened.
Yep.
It was perfect.
What else?
The end. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing else to say. I know that they shot on Cielo Drive. I know they shot up until the time they go up to the first house.
And then when you see the cul-de-sac, that's not the location, because there's no cul-de-sac up there.
But you can see the walk up Cielo Drive up into that. There's a guardrail there.
Mm.
And I know that they put the phony street lights there, and they put the old sign.
Because there's no street lights on Cielo, but otherwise that is Cielo. When you see it from the kind of the street that you turn off on, that's actual Cielo Drive. Yeah.
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 Man. Yeah, them driving down, you know, just when Brad Pitt's driving down the freeway and all those cars, think of the time that they had to put in, the money they spent to close down freeways.
I know, and they said that was really Pitt driving, and they said he was booking. He was doing 50, 55 in that little car Magia, whipping in, you know, in and out of traffic like that, yeah. Speaking of a story about a guy using stunt drivers, he did all that stuff, yeah.
Did he?
Yep.
Yeah, when we saw him on Hollywood Boulevard, everything was on a trailer, I think.
Oh, okay.
At that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there's much else to say about it, except it was absolutely stunning the way they put it back. This new version that they're going to have to release, because they are, one way or the other, either on DVD or on Netflix.
I want the 4-hour director's cut.
Yeah, easy, five, make it six. But I mean, like the time they spent restoring that entire block of Hollywood Boulevard, you know, and is literally in the background for probably 90 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, and all those scenes with Manson, the Sebring Salon, all that stuff, you know, literally didn't even make it.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a hell of a director's cut, a hell of a full length thing happening.
I also read that Tarantino has written like 4 or 6 episodes of the Bounty Law. Fake fictional show that, you know, Rick Dalton, that Leonardo DiCaprio's character is in. And he apparently is thinking about actually producing it. And if DiCaprio actually does that, that would be amazing.
That would be
crazy.
And
maybe that'll go on Netflix too. I don't know, but I want more of this world.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, the fact that he shoots on 35 is just crazy.
Or 70,
no
yeah.
monitors.
Mm-hmm.
It's only his bare eyes. And
yeah, he's a film purist. I think he shot this on 70mm.
Did he?
Because that's what, if you saw it in the dome, you saw a 70mm print projection of it.
Yeah.
So yeah. And that's what he shot The Hateful Eight on also.
They had to modify all those projectors around the country for that, for 70. Because when I was a projectionist, we used to show 70. And I showed Alien in 70mm. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. There's a lot to be said, and then there's not, you know, and it's hard to say anything because it's so perfect.
Yeah.
And that sounds so wanky, you know, because it's L.A. and we're always obsessed with ourselves.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really well represented. I just loved it. I thought Brad Pitt was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
DiCaprio. Somebody pointed out today that DiCaprio was playing an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really kind of involved. You know?
And it's crazy because, you know, Pitt got a lot of the praise in the reviews, but DiCaprio was every bit as good, if not better. He just didn't have the... Pitt was more of the hero character, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think he got a little bit more excitement. But one of the reasons I loved the Spawn Ranch scene was because I love smart characters doing smart things. And Brad Pitt was a smart character being smart in that scene. He saw right through the bullshit of the Manson girls feeding him about Spawn.
Yeah.
You could tell the moment when he was in the car with that girl and she said where they were staying, he was like, "You're all living out there?"
George is okay with that?
Yeah, you could tell. He's going, "I'm going to go out there and check on George."
Yeah.
And then he was like, "Well, I'm going to go over there anyways." And he's just total disdain for these, you know, these dirty hippie types that are, you know, selling this nonsense story. And then the whole scene with him and Spawn I felt was so real. And I just, it was, you know, that whole thing was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Not to mention the whole bit about with Bruce Lee, which got some controversy. That whole scene with Bruce Lee, where Bruce Lee is, you know, portrayed as a very arrogant person, And his family's not happy. And sitting in the theater the first time, I was like, oh, his family's not going to be happy about
this. I know, but I love his Tarantino just defended it. The daughter says he would never say that he could take Cassius Clay. And Tarantino goes, yes, he did.
He did.
It's in his book.
It's in the book, yeah.
So it was, and then she comes back with, like, he should shut up. that was really,
yeah.
That was it, the end. But, you know, it's difficult when you're portraying famous people that are their lives are documented, and there were so many of them in this movie. You know, he never consulted with Roman. Well, Roman Polanski got, you know, through certain channels, was able to find out what was going to be happening with it.
And when I first heard about this movie, when I first got announced, I was like, I'm not going to see that, because in my mind, he was going to do what he does with Tate and all of them, and I was like, I'm not going to see that. And then it won me over as I started to see what they were filming and hearing about everything. And then, you know what I mean? I completely pulled a 180 from how I originally felt about it.
I thought Margot Robbie was terrific. I don't know what Sharon Tate was like, but I think she was. And you know what was fucking brilliant is that then they showed the clips in the Wrecking Crew. They left Sharon in it.
Sharon Tate.
They didn't superimpose Margot Robbie.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty cool because Sharon gets another IMDb credit.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> As herself. Yeah. And would it be as herself? I guess as herself as an actor.
Probably.
Yeah, I guess it would be as herself. I don't know. Or archival. It would be as archival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is pretty, pretty cool.
And I felt like, I mean, she was a bit of a caricature of very innocent girl, which I'm sure she wasn't as innocent and Pollyannish as she is portrayed in the movie, but I think she represented the innocence of the 60s that was lost that night.
I think that...
What was at stake?
Of everyone that was up at that house that night, she's the only one that was transparent. You know, the only of all those people that were killed on Cielo Drive, she was the only one that there was no ulterior motive to her being there. Mm-hmm. She was just a woman who was going to have a baby and was thrilled about it.
Yeah.
Everyone else, there's mystery surrounding their placement.
Yeah.
But she is always 100% a woman that was there in her house, pregnant, ready to give birth, and thrilled to pieces and done.
Yeah.
So, it's really moving to see it for that reason alone, to see this film for the portrayal of Sharon Tate, because she's no longer just a black and white image, or some Valley of the Dolls. Yes, mother, I'm doing my bust exercises. It's just, you know, as a human being and just happy. And those scenes when they're dancing it was so moving. I love it.
And when she goes
to
the theater and she sees, you know, she goes and watches the Wrecking Crew and they don't recognize her at the movie theater yet. Cause I think it kind of drove home that she was not a huge, you know, A-list actress at that point. She might not have been recognized out on the street everywhere she went. Right.
Yeah, that's a misconception that she was one of the most famous women in the world. No, no. Roman was much more famous, and she was a beautiful, beautiful actress at his side.
Yeah.
Sharon has turned into a bigger deal.
Because of the murders. Yeah.
Otherwise, she'd have been, you know, like Tina Louise and Elke Summer and Nancy Kwan.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of around, but their careers aren't really going anywhere. And I don't think Sharon wanted a career like that. I think she was thrilled to pieces to be a homemaker.
Yep. There were a lot of actresses in this that I did not recognize because of the hair and makeup. Like Rumor Willis, I've seen it twice. I did not spot her.
Well, she plays Joanna Pettit, who's the one who is confusing for a moment because it looks like Sharon Tate when she rolls down the window. But Sharon shows her the nursery in the movie. And so she drives up and they go in and she shows her the nursery.
I had no idea.
That's Rumor Willis.
Because they changed everybody's appearance so much.
Yeah.
You know, like Dakota Fanning is squeaky, that I really had a hard time spotting a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I didn't recognize that was Maya Hawk as Kasabian. And even though I just watched her for 10 episodes of Stranger Things. Yeah. Huh. So with all that said, we as an announcement here on our show, we have been working on a new edition of the 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, our Manson documentary that we put out a decade ago. I think we get the rights back next month.
Oh, cool. I wanted to do this for a long time. We talked about this for years.
Yeah.
We talked about revisiting it and maybe doing a sequel.
Yeah.
But I think the footage we have is great.
And there's stuff that isn't around anymore, like Barker Ranch.
And stuff we wouldn't get the rights to get into again.
Uh-huh.
So I think that I cannot wait to update the information.
Yes.
Because back then I was still on Team Helter Skelter. I was still race war heavy.
Yeah.
And now I know more. Now that he is dead, now that Manson is dead and Bugliosi's dead, people are having real conversations about Manson's involvement and the motives behind these crimes.
Yeah. All right. So,
like, that was epic. Well, I hope that you guys enjoyed it, and you know, we love just hanging out and talking.
Yeah.
But it was as interesting to me. So yeah. Thanks.
All right, guys. Thanks. Well, until next time.
Adios.
I would think of something quirky to say, but I can't think of a quip.
No, it was something dumber than that. I'm the devil, and I'm here to
I'm
do
the devil.
No, it was dumber than that.
I'm the devil. I'm here to do. Yeah, that was so. Nah, what's your name? I'm the devil. I'm here to do the devil's work. Nah, it was dumber than that. All right, guys, it was dumber than that. See you next time.
Later.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.